Okay, so here we are. This is the second lecture on Chapter 12. Chapter 12 is on the financial crisis of 2007, 8, and its aftermath. So it's not just about the financial crisis of 2007 and 8, but a lot of what happened back then is still in operation today, and there's no guarantee that what happened back then can't happen again. And some economists think that things could even be worse than it was then, because some economists believe that we simply sugarcoated the problem and postponed it and made matters worse instead of better. But only the future will tell if that's right or not. So the last thing we talked about is was a collateralized debt obligation, but let me see, slideshow, and from current slide, yeah. The credit, a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation, is pretty central to modern finance, and y'all should know what that is by now. That's, remember, when we put money in the bank, or when we borrow money, let's say on a mortgage, banks don't keep that money, but they sell it. Now, who do banks sell their mortgages to? Anybody?
The government or private people?
No. Well, government is partially right, but they sell to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, I say partially right because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are essentially government agencies. It's a little bit tricky. Their status has changed over the years from being quasi-private to maybe more controlled by government. So, in essence, you're right there, but it is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. See, the whole reason why Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were brought into existence was to buy mortgages from banks. Now, why did Congress bring Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into existence? Well, their purpose was to stimulate the mortgage market, was to, how you say, get the circulation of money in a mortgage market going around quicker. Now, how do we do that? Well, see, the old way was that when people took a mortgage out from a bank, the bank would simply receive monthly payments over a period of 25 to 30 years. So money turned over very slowly, whereas with this new system, with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on the scene, instead of a bank keeping a mortgage, they sell their mortgage to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they get their money right up front, right away, which then gives the banks more money right away to lend out to other people. And therefore, we've rejuvenated the mortgage market. All right? So, so what does Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do with those mortgages? Anybody? I mean, how is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac going to make their money? They're going to sell the mortgages. But how do they sell the mortgages? I mean, do they just sell them individually, or what do they do? And bulk. And we call that bulk. Come on now, you're almost there. They sell them in bulk, they package them together, and we call this package a collateralized debt obligation, a CDO. So, according to what we said last time in that video that we just saw, now those that are listening to this MP3, tape. I don't put the videos I show on this the MP3 file, but it was a video about CDOs and the mortgage market, generally speaking, and the collapse of 2007. But the point I'm making now is that CDO is divided into three tranches, they're called, and then they're sold to investors. And the higher tranches, those mortgages that are safest are put into those higher tranches, and less safe mortgages are put into the middle section, and the very risky mortgages are put into the third tranche. And then we sell these to investors on the higher tranche where the mortgages are very safe. We sell them and give a lower interest because they're safe. You know, there's always an indirect relationship between safety and interest. If you borrow money and there's a lot of, if you lend money and there's a lot of risk, well, you're going to have to get a higher interest to compensate you for the higher risk. And so that's what's happening here. When mortgages have a low risk, then we're going to lend them out and charge and receive a lower interest or pay a lower interest. But on the risky, the third tranche, well, there's a lot of risk involved, so we're going to charge a much higher interest. It's going to be higher interest on in the third tranche. Now, the way it works is that what happens when some people stop paying on their mortgages? Well, those people in the lower tranche may not get paid. See, they bought these from the CDO, these investments, but now there's not enough money to pay everybody, so these people don't get paid. Now, if there's more defaults, then people in the middle tranche may not get paid, and we would have to have a total collapse where almost nobody makes payments on our mortgages in order for the people in the first tranche not to get paid. But this is how CDOs work. Now, what happened is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac made and are making still a lot of money doing this by buying mortgages from banks, repackaging the mortgages in CDOs, and then selling off bits and pieces of that CDO to investors. So what happened back in the early 2000s is that banks said, oh, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are making a killing, but we can't compete in the mortgage market because there is either a real or implied guarantee. Because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are, back then, they were quasi-government agencies. They were more independent than they are today. But still, people thought that if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac went bankrupt, that the government would simply bail them out. And so there was some safety there. And so Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were able to sell these investments and offer a lower interest because people thought that, well, there's a government guarantee here. So banks couldn't compete. But what banks did is that they said, well, we can do the same thing in other type loans. I mean, we don't have to make up a CDO just with mortgages. We can make up CDOs out of any kind of loans. I mean, student loans or automobile loans or credit card loans or even a combination of different type loans. And so that's what banks started to do. They started to play the same game, you know, buying debt, packaging them up in CDOs, and then selling off bits and pieces in other type loans. And they still do today. So what is the purpose of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Its purpose is to expand the secondary mortgage market. Now, remember, when you go to the bank to borrow money, that's the primary market. But when the bank sells your mortgage to somebody else, that's the secondary market. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are involved in what is called the secondary market. And this here's a term here. It says its purpose is to expand the secondary mortgage market by securitizing mortgages. So this practice of bundling debts into a package is called securitization. So that's a term that you ought to be familiar with. It's called securitizing debts or debt instruments. By securitizing mortgages in the form of mortgage-backed securities. Now, a mortgage-backed security is a CDO that is made up of just mortgages. But a typical mortgage-backed security would be a CDO where they haven't divided up the mortgages in terms of risk level. That, you know, a mortgage-backed security would be they would sell off bits and pieces, but everyone is receiving the same interest. But so a CDO is a special type of mortgage-backed security. And Freddie Mac, you know, authorized by Congress in 1972 to purchase private mortgages on the secondary market to compete with Fannie Mae. See, Fannie Mae was the first one, but the volume was so large and they had monopoly, so Congress said, well, we ought to have more competition here, and two can handle the volume better than one. So that's when they instituted a Freddie Mac to compete with Fannie Mae. But they're essentially the same. They both buy mortgages from banks, and then they sell these mortgages. They securitize these mortgages and sell it like in CDOs and sell them off to investors. See, I'm repeating a lot of these terms because I know that these terms are very unfamiliar to you, but the more you hear them, you know, the more you hear collateralized debt obligation and securitization, then the more familiar these terms will be to you. And these, you know, are terms that if you don't understand these terms, then you're not going to understand modern finance. And you're not going to understand, you know, what happened back in 2007, 2008 when the financial market imploded. And you may not, I mean, if a similar thing happens again, you're not going to understand what's happening. And that's really the purpose of this whole chapter and this course, for that matter, is hopefully you're going to understand whatever happens, whether it be good or bad, you've got some understanding of why things work the way they do. So what are some problems with securitizing debt? The complexity can limit investors' ability to monitor risk and make it more difficult to standardize the market. See, if you lend money to one person, then it's fairly easy to monitor your risk. It's fairly easy to do due diligence, it's called, on that lender, I mean, on that borrower, and to ascertain whether this person who wants to borrow money is a good credit risk or not. You know, you look at the person's credit record and background, work background, income potential, and things like that. But if you've got a bunch of people that have borrowed money and they're all part of a group, then it's more difficult to ascertain, oh, well, now, how much risk is involved here? I mean, what if I buy this debt instrument, what, you know, what's the risk of these people not, you know, of defaulting on their loan? Well, that's much more difficult if you have a bunch of people in one debt instrument as opposed to one person. So that is one problem with this practice of securitizing debt. And leverage, something this video we saw just talked a lot about, and you all should know what leverage is by now, the act of using borrowed money to make bets on some future event. You know, if you borrow money, like in the stock market, it's called buying stock on the margin. If you buy stock on the margin, then you put down some money of your own, but then you borrow the rest, and in the stock market, that might be from your stockbroker, and so you can buy more shares of stock because you borrowed money. So, like, if the margin requirement's 50%, then for every dollar you put down, the brokerage house will or their, you know, your stockbroker will give you, let's say, a dollar. For every dollar you put down, stockbroker gives you a dollar. So instead of buying one share of stock for a dollar, you can buy two shares. So you double, if the margin requirement is 50%, you can double the shares of stock you buy. So when the price of those stocks go up, then you can double your return, because instead of owning one share and gaining on that one share, you own two shares, so you gain twice as much when the price of stock goes up. And that's called leverage. That's one way that in the financial world that you can practice leverage. But that's the upside of leverage. What's the downside of leverage?
You borrow a bunch of money and then you don't get your money back, and then you owe your money.
Yeah. Right. The multiplication with leverage, the multiplication process is great going up, and it's multiplied going up, but it's also multiplied coming down. So, like, instead of buying one share of stock, you buy two shares of stock. But if the price of that stock goes down, then you've lost twice as much as you would have if you had only owned one share. Now, we're talking here about leverage, you know, 1 to 2. You know, for every $1 you invest, for every $1 you borrow a dollar. But what banks did back other financial firms did back before, you know, early 2000s, the ratio was more like 30 to 1. You put $1 down and you borrowed $30. So instead of buying one share with your own money, you bought 30 shares, or maybe 31 shares, and only one of those dollars is yours and the rest is borrowed. Well, if leverage is 30 to 1, then if the price of stocks go up, man, you can make a killing, right? But just as it's great multiplication going up, it's equal multiplication coming down. And, of course, that's what happens. When leverage gets too high, then you can create a bubble, because a lot of people are doing this. It's very profitable. But when things start to go down, then the collapse is that much greater, and so the whole bubble bursts. And in fact, that's exactly what happened back in 2007, 2008. You know, we hit from 2000, 2001, 2003, 2005. You know, we had this a lot of leverage, and it was like we were blowing up this balloon. But then things started to go south, as they always do at some point, for whatever reason. But things start to go south, and because you got so much leverage, the downward trend is multiplied. And what happened back then in 2008 is that we had a total financial collapse. I mean, our financial system completely imploded. So leverage is a very important concept, extremely important. So what is a subprime mortgage? Well, a type of mortgage which involved a high level of risk to the lender, in some cases actual deceit and fraud. So the prime mortgage market is when you lend money to very creditworthy people. The subprime mortgage market is when you loan money to people who are not good credit risks, okay? And, of course, that's what happened back then. And, again, you know, what we're really talking about here is the events that occurred somewhere, you know, around 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, you know, leading up to, 2007. That's really what we're talking about. So I'm not going to keep repeating that, but if you can get that time frame starting somewhere around the year 2000, then that'll help you understand this. Now, here's a very important point. I've talked to you about securitizing of debts and collateralized debt obligations. And what's coming up is I'm going to talk to you about what a credit default swap is. But the point I want to make now is is there anything wrong with this practice of securitizing of debts? And the answer to that question is no, there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, it's a good, sound business practice. Now, if it's a good, sound business practice, then what happened? How come things imploded back in 2007? And the answer is subprime mortgages. Subprime mortgages. See, the fault was not in the system. The fault was in what was in these CDOs. If these CDOs had been made up of prime mortgages, then we would not have had the financial collapse. But the point is that these CDOs were not, most of them were not made up of prime mortgages, but they were made up of subprime mortgages or subprime loans. Now, the mortgage market was the major market back here. So we're going to talk about the mortgage market also, but the same thing can apply to other type markets, you know, like the student loan market or the credit card market or the automobile market. But mainly what we're talking about here is historically is the mortgage market. So now what is an Alt-A loan? Sometimes called liar loans, they require less documentation than traditional subprime loans. So you've got prime loans, you've got subprime loans, and then even below subprime loans, you've got another category called Alt-A loans. Now, the reason why they were nicknamed liar loans is that banks were so anxious. You see, here's the deal. If you lend money to somebody, and before the ink is dry on the loan document, you sell this debt to someone else, do you care if this person defaults on their loan or not? I mean, does it make any difference to you? It makes no difference because you don't own the debt anymore, right? You lend money to somebody, they can be a terrible credit risk. There's maybe 100% chance that they're going to default on their loan, but who cares? Because if you can sell that loan the day that you make it, well, you get your money regardless of if this person defaults or not. So this became such a lucrative business for so many financial firms that they were eager to lend more money out. And so one thing that they came up with are these Alt-A loans. They said, look, you come to the bank and we'll lend you money. If you say that you make, you know, let's say, you know, you're flipping, your job is flipping burgers at McDonald's and you make $20,000 a year. But if you come into our bank and you tell us that you make $100,000 a year, we're not going to check up on it. That's totally legal. So you can come in and just give us any facts you want. You can lie, and we're going to lend you money based on your lies. Now, can you imagine a financial system where you've got such loans, where it's totally legal to fabricate, to lie about your finances, financial ability to repay a loan? I mean, you see, it's no wonder that things collapsed. And it's no wonder that a great big bubble built up that eventually dispersed. Anyway, these are called Alt-A loans. That's actually the official name, Alt-A. It's a category of loans, liar loans. What was the policy of Alan Greenspan, chair of the Fed from 1987 to 2006? The easy money policies of the Fed during the Greenspan's tenure, you notice 1987 to 2006, you know, the collapse was started in, you know, midway through 2007, has been suggested to be a leading cause of the subprime mortgage crisis. So easy money policies. you know, easy, what easy money means is, you know, low interest rates, non-documentation of loans. You know, that's easy money. You know, it's easy for people to borrow money. So the under Alan Greenspan, it became very easy for people to borrow money. Everybody, no matter what your credit history is, everyone could borrow money, especially in the mortgage market. See, part of what fueled this whole thing was that up until this time, housing prices always went up. So equity went up. If you owned a home, maybe you paid $100,000 for the home, but 5 years later, the home was worth $200,000 or $300,000. Well, see, then the equity in that house, as the price of that house increases, the market price of that house increases, then equity in that house increases. And as equity increased in the mortgage market, then these loans increase because you're basing your lending on a higher price tag, so to speak. Why were easy money policies of the Fed a factor in the mortgage crisis? People borrowed money to buy homes. The price of homes increased. See, their equity increased, okay. And many people borrowed against the home's equity. See, now what happened is, okay, you buy a house for $100,000. But we got a bubble going on here. Prices are increasing. A couple years later, your house is worth, let's say, $250,000. Well, you paid $100,000 for it, but now the house is worth, let's say you bought the house for zero down. You know, no money down. You buy a $100,000 house, no money down. But 2 years later, that house is worth $250,000. Well, you've got, even though you haven't paid anything toward the principal, you've got $150,000 here of equity. And you can go to the bank and you can borrow money based on that $150,000 equity. And so that's what people did. As housing prices were going up back in the early 2000s, people said, wow, hey, now I've got equity. I can go to the bank and I can borrow money on this equity and I can do all kinds of things. You know, I can take vacations. You know, I can take my kids to Disneyland. I can buy that boat I've always wanted. I can buy a bigger house. We can remodel our kitchen. You know, we can do a lot of things. You know, I can buy a brand new car. And so that's what people did. Well, now what's happening here? I mean, notice here, this equity is just on paper, right? I mean, the house is the same house. The house is no bigger than it was, right? Physically, it's the same house. So what we've got here is simply zeros and ones. I mean, it's just funny money. It's just fluff is what it is. It's fluff. But yet people can borrow on this fluff, and they buy this. You know, they buy things for the kitchen, and they buy boats, and they buy cars. Well, what does this do to the economy? Well, it rejuvenates the economy. And now, again, what are we doing? Well, we're building a bubble. We're throwing kerosene on the fire, so to speak. See, what is the Housing and Community Development Act of 1977? Banks were required to make substantial loans to low-income persons, even with bad credit ratings. Now, we're going to get back into a little history of, what really triggered this bubble back in the early 2000s? Now, there's lots of places you could start, but I just happened to start in 1977 with the Housing and Community Development Act of 1977, because there's several Housing and Community Development Acts, because this act has been revised several times over the years. So that's why, the date 1977 is important. This was, I believe, the first one. But Congress decides that wouldn't it be nice if everyone in America owned a home? They said, you know, owning your own home is the American dream. And if more people own their own homes, they would have more at stake. They would take more pride in being homeowners. They would take good care of their homes, and they would be just, you know, better people. So we think that, you know, almost everyone in America that wants a home ought to be able to buy a home. So we're going to mandate that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac buy so many mortgages that are subprime. In other words, we're going to put pressure on banks to lend money to non-credit-worthy people. And we're going to tell Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that a certain percentage of the loans that they buy from banks have to be subprime. Now, do you see what we're doing here? So now banks are mandated by government, by this Housing and Community Development Act of 1977, they're mandated to lend money to non-credit-worthy people. Now, how are they going to do this? Well, this becomes a problem. I mean, if they practice lending their previous way of lending money, you know, if they did due diligence and they did credit investigations and you know, they lent money to just creditworthy people, well, they would be in violation of the law. Well, now how are we going to meet this government mandate? Well, let's come up with Alt-A loans. Yeah. Let's come up with Alt-A loans. See, and let's do, you know, say banks were forced at this point to come up, to be very creative, to do whatever they could to attract more people into the mortgage market in order to meet government mandates. Y'all find this interesting? I find this very interesting that this is, see, in a way, the collapse was inevitable because it all came about because it's like passing a law that guaranteed an economic collapse, because that's exactly what we did. And this is only one example. This was the beginning. This Housing Community Development Act 1977 was just the beginning of this. See, this is the story of how politicians can get these idealistic ideas and say, oh, wouldn't it be nice for everyone in America to own a home? So let's pass a law that makes that so. And not understanding economics and just being consumed with their idealism, the financial collapse of 2007-2008 is the result. And same is true today, by the way. Nothing's changed. Why did Fannie and Fred defraud investors? To increase mortgage share in the subprime loan market and to meet the demands of the Housing Community Development Act of 1977. See, we even got to the point where not only did we have these Alt-A loans, but we had all kinds of ways to defraud investors. Now, the investors we're talking about here are like pension funds. You know, you people work and their company has a pension fund, and so people, you know, put money into that pension fund. Well, what does the pension fund do with this money? Well, they invest it. Well, these are, you know, you're talking about a lot of money here. You're not talking about just individuals. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of individuals who have pooled their money, and then we're taking this pool of money and investing it. Well, there was a lot of fraud in this. I'm going to get into exactly the details of some of the major frauds, but there were whole countries like Iceland If you watch that video called The Inside Job that goes along with this chapter, the first thing that Matt Damon talks about is Iceland, because the whole country was defrauded and went bankrupt. Now, you're talking about a whole country, and at that time, it was a very prosperous country. But we'll get into that in more detail here before the end of this chapter. What is the Housing and Community Development Act of 1992? Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were required to meet a goal of 30% more mortgages bought should be from low and moderate income families. And that was raised to 55% in 2007. So in 1992, the government said, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, 30% of the mortgages you buy must be in the subprime category. And then they kept raising it. So by 2007, a full 55% of all mortgages that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were buying had to be subprime by law. I find it pretty amazing. What pressure was put on Fannie Mae in 1999? The Clinton administration encouraged an increase in loan purchases stemming from inner city areas and pressed for an easing of standards in the primary mortgage market. So 1999, again, it's a series of laws that made it easier and easier for people to borrow money, especially for mortgages. And not only did we do this in the subprime market, but we, with this 1999 law, you know, things that the pressure was put on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to even lower requirements in the primary mortgage market. What mandates were put on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in 2004? They were required to purchase subprime loans from banks to the tune of about $1 billion per week. So again, it's a series of increasing the involvement that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had in the subprime mortgage market. Now they've got a mandate of actually buying $1 billion a week of subprime high-risk mortgages. What is the Securities and Exchange Commission, called the SEC? This commission is responsible for enforcing the federal securities law and regulating the securities industry. So if you're talking about CDOs, you know, collateralized debt obligations, you're talking about, the subprime mortgage market, well, what government agency is most responsible for this sector of the economy? And the answer is the Securities and Exchange Commission. So the policies of the Securities and Exchange Commission have a profound effect on this market, on this, especially like the mortgage market. What did the SEC do in 2004? Now, these dates are important because, you know, all this is leading up to 2007. Because it was in 2007 that the system imploded, that it collapsed. So what we're doing here is we're looking, historically, we're looking at, what happened? What were the events that occurred that led up to the events of 2007? So here we are in 2004. So what did the SEC do in 2004 that affected the securities market? Now, see, mortgage loans are part of the securities market. You know, securities are debt instruments. Somebody borrows money. There's a piece of paper that is an agreement between a borrower and a lender, and that's called a security. All right? So this is the securities market. The mortgage market is a part of the securities market. It allowed banks to set their own debt to net capital rule, which changed the industry standard from 12 to 1 capital to 40 to 1. Now, this is where leverage comes in. See, before 2004, the ratio was 12 to 1. In other words, for every $1 a bank had in deposit, they could lend out $12. But after 2004, what the Securities and Exchange Commission said is that, well, we're not going to police this ratio anymore. We're not going to put standards on you banks anymore in terms of your leverage. We're going to let you decide what is the proper leverage. So right away, I mean, the banks were given a free hand to determine their own debt-to-income ratio. So it went in no time from a 12-to-1 ratio to a 40-to-1 ratio, which means that in no time after 2004, for every $1 banks took in, they could lend out $40. Now, what's happening to leverage here? We got a whole lot more leverage, right? And again, more leverage you have, the more money everyone makes, but you're building a bubble, and when the bubble bursts, the downturn is multiplied because of the leverage, because of the excessive leverage. And that's exactly what happened. Now, notice the date here, 2004. Again, you know, what we're doing is we're pointing to 2007. Oh, what happened right before 2007 that led to the collapse? What caused the collapse? See, now I'm being very specific with you. Which firms benefited the most from this change in legal ratios? Goldman Sachs, an investment bank, Bear Stearns, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, and Lehman Brothers. Now, all these are investment banks. Now, back then, they were truly investment banks. Now, remember, after these were investment banks that later. Now, all of these went bankrupt as a result of 2007, except Goldman Sachs. When I say they went bankrupt, they all became a part of other bigger financial firms. See, that's what we do. Instead of if a bank goes bankrupt, well, they don't just disappear. But what normally happens is a bigger bank will purchase what's left of the bankrupt bank, and then that bank, that smaller bank, becomes a part of the bigger bank. And that's happened here. What happened in 2008 to these investment banks? They all collapsed and either disappeared or were converted to bank holding companies so they could be bailed out by the Fed. Now, what a bank holding company is if you have a corporation, but that corporation buys a bank, now that bank may only represent a very small portion of this total corporation, maybe only 1%. But because this corporation, in its overall organization owns a bank, it becomes what is called a bank holding company. And by being a bank holding company, it qualifies for a lot of the perks that banks receive from the Federal Reserve and the federal government. And so so a lot of these investment companies that were not banks became bank holding companies, and therefore they became quasi-banks as a result of the collapse. What is the Private Securities Litigation Act of 1995? This act protected Wall Street firms from legal suits and restricted investors from saving banks and banks for fraud. In other words, what this act did in 1995, it said banks that are guilty of wrongful doing cannot be persecuted. Does that sink into you all? I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, here's the law that says, hey, banks, you can defraud your investors, and that's okay, and we're not going to do anything about it. That was actually made a law in 1995. I mean, is it no wonder that things fell apart? See, this act protected Wall Street firms, you know, these investment companies and banks, but a lot of it was investment companies, from legal suits that, you know, people, in other words, if you went to Goldman Sachs and Goldman Sachs defrauded you, you know, Goldman Sachs lied to you and you lost a bunch of money, can you sue Goldman Sachs for wrongful doing? And the answer is, after 1995, no. By law, even though you were defrauded and you were lied to and you lost a bunch of money, you can't sue banks like, or investment companies like Goldman Sachs. Now, do you think that Goldman Sachs and other type firms had some input into laws passed in Congress? I mean, think about that. Do you think that Goldman Sachs, through lobbying efforts and plowing money into D.C., had something to do with laws passed that would protect them from any legal action from what was before illegal but now made legal? Something to think about. Now, I don't have any facts on that. That's a conjecture. But I think it's a pretty fair conjecture. What was the result of the secondary mortgage market and the Private Securities Litigation Act of 1995? They gave banks and mortgage-related companies a free hand to engage in high levels of speculation and fraud. You know, fraud is simply... Oh, I'm sorry. Thanks. I rest my... It's right in front of me, and if I touch it, it sometimes goes off. Thanks. Well, I don't know where I went off, but what was the result of the secondary mortgage market and the Private Securities Litigation Act of 1995? They gave banks and mortgage-related companies a free hand to engage in high levels of speculation and fraud. Amazing. Now, who is Angelo Mozzello, and what is Countrywide Mortgage? Now, this is where, this is material that makes for great novels, all right? I mean, this is really great storytelling stuff here. Angelo Mozzello founded Countrywide, a mortgage company that specialized in subprime mortgages. So, in other words, we have a mortgage company here. It's not a bank, but they're funded by private investors. And the way they make their profit is that they lend money to people to buy mortgages. But they don't lend money just to anyone that wants to buy a mortgage. They specialize in lending money to high-risk people, to people who you know, they specialize in these Alt-A loans. You know, they specialized in liar loans. And they specialized in just deceit and fraud to try to get more and more people to take out these mortgages. Because remember, what difference does it make with companies like Countrywide if they don't hold these mortgages? you know, if they don't hold these mortgages, but they simply sell them to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, well, they get their money right up front. So the more people that they can encourage, even deceitfully, to borrow money, well, the better off, the more money they're going to make. In fact, now this is something that's pretty amazing, but there was a partnership between Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Countrywide. You see, the government mandated Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to lend money to high-risk people. Well, how are they going to meet this mandate? Well, one of the ways they're going to meet this mandate is to partner with Countrywide. Countrywide now is a country with it. I mean, the name comes from, you know, it's ocean to ocean. It's a countrywide, you know, business. It's in all states. It's a it became a huge, you know, multi-billion dollar business. And since it specialized in lending money to high-risk people, it specialized in Alt-A loans. Well, that was a natural relationship between them and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because it helped Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac meet these mandates put upon them by the federal government. And Angelo Mazzello, of course, became very wealthy. And I read a book about Angelo Mazzello and Countrywide. It's a fascinating book. But they would do things like, very deceitful. They would lie to people. They would, that came in to borrow money. I remember this one story where people had to sign these papers, and they had to sign maybe, you know, 20 pieces of paper. And the first three pages or so were documentation that was sort of on the up and up. And then as you got down deeper, it became, if you read everything on the page, it became pretty obvious that this is something you don't want to sign. But people would look at the first two or three pages and they say, well, this looks good, this looks good, this looks good. And then they would just keep signing as they went down through the pages. Well, as soon as they left, the first three or four pages were just fluff pages. They were no good, and they were just thrown in the wastebasket. But, you know, they were just there to encourage people to sign the rest of the pages. So that was just one way of deceiving people when it came to borrowing money. Anyway, we've run out of time. This is slide 38, so we got a little ways to go here. But I'm going to finish this story, because it is a story. I'm going to finish this story next time. So I'll see you all next time. Good.